Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you, wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
It's great to be here for another deep dive.
You know, it is a staggering reality that even with all of our modern medicine, a microscopic organism can just completely bypass our defenses.
Oh, absolutely. We see it all the time.
Like, consider a bacteria called Shigella. It causes shigellosis, which is the severe form of bacillary dysentery, and this single pathogen is responsible for an estimated 1.1 million deaths worldwide every single year.
Yeah, the human toll is just devastating. And what makes Shigella particularly difficult to manage is its increasing resistance to our current antibiotics.
It's terrifying, honestly.
It really is. We are essentially locked in an arms race with an incredibly adaptable biological system.
And the way this pathogen operates is so highly sophisticated. So I want to pose this to you, the listener. What really happens when a disease-causing bacteria hijacks its own cellular machinery to ramp up its virulence?
Well, the trigger is actually a tiny molecular machine. It's an enzyme-modifying RNA, and it acts as a master switch.
A master switch that just selectively dials up the production of proteins, right? The ones the bacteria absolutely must have to survive the hostile environment of the human gut and, you know, infect the host.
Exactly. But here's the critical question. How could fundamentally misunderstanding the shape of this microscopic machine delay our ability to develop life-saving antibiotics?
That tension sits at the very heart of the research we are unpacking today.
Because for decades, structural biologists and drug developers have been designing inhibitors based on a fundamentally flawed map of this enzyme's active state.
Which is wild to think about.
Right. Seeing its true functional structure for the first time completely upends decades of established biological dogma.
Today, we celebrate the work of the team at the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, who have advanced our understanding of tRNA modification enzymes.
To understand why this team's work is such a massive leap forward, we have to look at the specific scientific mechanism driving that lethal Shigella infection.
Right. The target here is an enzyme called TGT, or tRNA guanine transglycosylase.
Yeah, and TGT's job is highly specific. It targets the anticodon loop of specific tRNAs, and it forcefully swaps out a standard guanine nucleobase for a hypermodified precursor molecule.
That's the pre-Q1 molecule, right?
Exactly, pre-Q1. And it does this right at the wobble position of the anticodon. By tweaking that single position, TGT changes the hydrogen bonding dynamics during translation in the ribosome.
Okay, let's unpack this. Think of TGT as a highly specialized proofreader that tweaks the genetic code right before it goes to print, you know, thereby turning a harmless bug into a deadly pathogen.
That is a perfect analogy. That subtle shift in how the genetic code is read by the proofreader is exactly what upregulates the translation of the virulence factor Shigella needs to become deadly.
It's a pretty brilliant evolutionary strategy, honestly.
Oh, it's incredible. The bacteria isn't mutating its own genome to become virulent. I mean, it is modifying the translation machinery on the fly.
Wow. And because this specific TGT-mediated modification is what arms the pathogen, the enzyme itself is this massive glowing target for antibiotic development.
Precisely. Strip the bacteria of its ability to make that pre-Q1 swap, and you effectively disarm it.
But of course, designing a drug to block that active site requires an atomic-level blueprint of the machine, which brings up an interesting choice by the research team.
Right, they didn't actually study the Shigella enzyme directly.
Yeah, they used E. coli TGT as their model instead, which might sound counterintuitive to some people.
It might, but the sequence identity between the TGT enzyme and E. coli and Shigella is virtually identical. We're talking like hovering between 99% and 100%, depending on the strain.
So for all structural and functional intents and purposes, they are the exact same molecular machine.
Exactly. Using E. coli TGT is incredibly pragmatic. It allows researchers to work with a highly characterized, easily accessible model system that translates perfectly to the disease mechanism.
But even with that advantage, mapping the actual three-dimensional structure of the E. coli enzyme in its active state has been, well, an absolute nightmare for structural biologists.
A total nightmare, because E. coli TGT simply refuses to crystallize.
And for decades, the gold standard for getting these high-resolution blueprints has been X-ray crystallography, right?
Right, which requires coaxing proteins to pack neatly into a rigid, highly ordered crystal lattice.
But E. coli TGT has these highly flexible peripheral domains, so trying to crystallize it is like trying to build a rigid brick wall, but half the bricks have loose metal springs attached to them.
Yeah, the surface entropy is just too high, and they just won't pack together.
So what's the traditional workaround in structural biology when you're faced with that kind of problem?
Well, usually researchers use a surrogate. In this case, they turn to the TGT enzyme from another bacteria, primarily Zymomonas mobilis, which, unlike E. coli, does form beautiful crystals.
And they used those surrogate structures to build their models and design their drugs?
They did, but here's the catch. The Z. mobilis enzyme is only about 56% identical to the Shigella and E. coli TGT.
Oh, wow. So barely over half.
Right. I mean, the core catalytic pocket might be somewhat conserved, but a 44% sequence difference is fatal for rational drug design.
Because the peripheral domains, the electrostatic charges, the exact angstrom level distances, they're all entirely different.
Exactly. Building a custom drug for Shigella based on the Z. mobilis structure is basically operating with a massive structural blind spot.
Recognizing that blind spot, the UC San Diego team decided to abandon X-ray crystallography entirely, didn't they?
They did. To see the native E. coli enzyme, they turned to cryo-electron microscopy, or cryo-EM.
And because cryo-EM doesn't require a crystal lattice, you can observe the protein in its native dynamic state.
Yes. And capturing it in a dynamic state was crucial. They didn't just want a static model of the enzyme resting in a vacuum.
They wanted to see it in action, actively bound to its full-length tRNA substrate.
Right. And to pull that off, they used a brilliant chemical trap, a molecule called 9-deazoguanine.
The mechanism of that trap is so elegant.
It really is. So during the normal reaction, TGT binds the RNA, cuts out the guanine base, and temporarily forms a covalent bond between its own catalytic aspartate residue and the RNA backbone.
And then it normally inserts the pre-Q1 base and releases the RNA.
Right. But the 9-diazoguanine molecule lacks a specific nitrogen atom that is required for the enzyme to complete that final cleavage.
So it basically jams the machinery at the halfway point.
Exactly. The enzyme cuts the guanine, forms that covalent bond with the RNA backbone, and then it just freezes.
It creates a highly stable covalent intermediate. So going back to our analogy, the proofreader's hand is essentially glued to the manuscript mid-edit.
Yes, and that allowed the cryo-EM to capture the complex at a resolution of 3.5 angstroms.
And at 3.5 angstroms, I mean, you are looking at individual amino acid side chains. You can see the exact orientation of the RNA bases.
You really can. And catching the enzyme mid-edit in this native state is what shattered the long-standing dogma about how this machine operates.
Right, because for years, the biological assumption, which was based heavily on the surrogate crystal structures, was that TGT existed as a homonor, a two-part complex.
Yes, but they got it functioned with negative cooperativity, or half of the site's reactivity.
Meaning, the accepted model was that when one active site bound a tRNA, it sterically blocked the other subunit.
Exactly. The second half of the dimer was assumed to be dormant. People thought it just acted merely as a scaffold.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The cryo-EM reconstruction revealed a completely different reality.
It did. The images clearly showed the E. coli TGT dimer bound to two separate full-length tRNA molecules simultaneously.
It is not a single-action machine. It is a highly efficient bivalent complex. It is the molecular equivalent of realizing you are holding a single-barrel shotgun, only to discover it's actually a double-barrel shotgun capable of firing both barrels at once.
That is exactly what it is. And the complex forms this beautiful C2 symmetry. The two active sites and the two massive tRNA molecules bound to them are oriented facing away from each other.
They're perfectly balanced in three-dimensional space.
Right, which perfectly explains why there is no steric clash.
Seeing a TGT from any domain of life form a covalent intermediate with two RNAs at once, it just completely changes our understanding of its kinetics.
It really does.
Yeah.
But the real treasure in this 3.5 angstrom data is the map of the molecular interactions happening outside the active site.
Oh, definitely. The enzyme doesn't just recognize the sequence, it mechanically grips the backbone.
Yeah. The structural data highlights a specific stretch of positively charged amino acids on the E. coli TGT protein. We're talking about lysine 285, lysine 292, and arginine 320.
And since the RNA phosphate backbone carries a strong negative charge, These positively charged residues act as magnetic clamps.
Exactly. They grab the stem of the tRNA and they just forcefully lock it into the correct orientation.
And the necessity of those peripheral clamps was proven through mutational analysis, right?
Yes. The researchers targeted lysine 292. They made the K292D mutation, which basically swaps the positively charged lysine for a negatively charged aspartate.
So flipping that charge turns a magnetic clamp into a magnetic repulsor?
Precisely. It pushes the RNA backbone away. And the result of that single amino acid change was a complete loss of enzyme activity.
The enzyme couldn't form the covalent intermediate at all.
Nope. Without those peripheral clamps anchoring the RNA stem, the active site is completely useless.
And the enzyme needs that intense mechanical grip because of what it forces the RNA to do next.
Right. To expose the target guanine base to the deep catalytic pocket, the anticodon loop of the tRNA undergoes a violent physical distortion.
It executes a 180-degree upward flip. It bends almost completely backwards on itself.
Yeah, and forcing an RNA strand into a 180-degree backbend creates an incredibly precarious high-energy state.
So to stabilize that extreme kink, the enzyme has a built-in safety mechanism.
It does. In the free, unbound enzyme, there is a small loop of amino acids residues L98 to I104 that is highly flexible and disordered.
Which, ironically, is one of the main reasons this enzyme wouldn't crystallize in the first place.
Exactly. But when the tRNA undergoes that backward flip, the physical strain forces three specific RNA bases out of the standard helical structure.
And one of those flipped out bases is adenine 37.
Yes. Yep. And the moment A37 flips out of the RNA helix, that previously floppy L98 to I104 loop on the enzyme suddenly snaps to attention.
It becomes highly ordered. It packs tightly against the A37 base through hydrophobic base stacking interactions.
Right. The flexible loop basically acts like a seatbelt that only engages and tightens the moment the RNA executes the backbend,
locking the entire structure in place so the catalytic aspartate can do its work.
The transition from a disordered loop to an ordered structural support is just a textbook example of induced fit. The enzyme and the substrate mutually dictate each other's final active conformation.
And understanding these precise mechanics, you know, the magnetic clamps, the 180-degree flip, the seatbelt loop, it gives drug designers an incredible array of new targets to disrupt the Shigella enzyme.
Disrupting the enzyme is definitely the clinical goal, but the implications of this double-barrel C2 symmetry extend way beyond antibiotics.
Right, because TGT is widely used in biotechnology as a highly promiscuous RNA labeling tool.
Yes. In vitro, TGT doesn't actually require a massive, full-length tRNA to function. You can feed it a synthetic miniature version of the anticodon loop, which is known as a TG3 hairpin.
And researchers use this technology called RNA tag to attach fluorescent dyes, functional groups, or specific stabilizing modifications to synthetic mRNA.
It is an essential technology for the development of mRNA therapeutics, advanced vaccines, and even for tracking CRISPR guide RNAs inside cells.
But the efficiency of that labeling process entirely depends on how tightly the TGT enzyme binds to the TAGI3 handle.
Oh, exactly. And by revealing that the E. coli TGT dimer has two fully functional active sites facing away from each other, the UC San Diego team realized they could engineer a vastly superior synthetic substrate.
Instead of giving the enzyme a single TAGI3 hairpin, they designed a bivalent molecule, right? A dual TAGI3-2 construct.
They did. The engineering challenge was finding the exact physical distance required to bridge those two active sites simultaneously.
Because of the C2 symmetry, the active sites are spatially separated.
Right. So the team had to synthesize different linker lengths to connect the two TIGI3 hairpins. Ultimately, they discovered that a 20-nucleotide linker, the N20 construct, was the topological sweet spot.
The N20 linker provided the exact flexibility and length needed to snake around the protein complex and engage both barrels at once.
And the kinetic data proves the design works flawlessly. I mean, when measuring binding affinity, a lower dissociation constant, or KD, indicates a much tighter, more stable interaction.
Right. And a standard single TAG3 hairpin has a KD hovering around 3 to 5 micromolar.
But the bivalent dual TAG32N20 construct caused that affinity to skyrocket. The apparent KD dropped to roughly 0.7 to 1 micromolar.
That is a massive leap in biochemical efficiency.
It really is. In competitive assays, the bivalent construct completely dominated the single hairpin, essentially monopolizing the enzyme's attention.
Wait, this double binding trick is amazing in a test tube, but does this actually happen inside a living, messy E. coli cell where TGT levels might be low?
That is such a good point to raise. The N20 construct is brilliant synthetic engineering, but the intracellular environment is definitely chaotic.
Right, it's not a controlled test tube where you set the molarity.
Exactly. But the statistical probability of the double-bound state comes down to relative abundance, not just absolute concentration.
Okay, walk us through that.
So while TGT enzyme levels are relatively low, the cell manufactures an astronomical amount of tRNA to sustain continuous protein translation.
Ah, so the intracellular tRNA pool exists in vast stoichiometric excess compared to the TGT dimer.
Yes. Because the substrate so heavily outnumbers the enzyme, the active sites are constantly flooded. Statistically, in vivo, the TGT dimer is almost certainly operating in its fully saturated double-bound state.
That is incredible. A foundational biological mechanism, one that dictates both bacterial virulence and advanced RNA modification, completely reimagined simply because we finally found a way to observe the actual structural dynamics rather than relying on static surrogates.
And the transition from X-ray crystallography surrogates to native cryo-EM structures is going to continue revealing these previously hidden bivalent and multivalent interactions across all domains of molecular biology.
So let's distill all of this down to the core takeaway for this deep dive. E. coli TGT defies structural paradigms by engaging two tRNAs simultaneously rather than just one. This dual action capability not only shifts our approach to designing antibiotics against deadly pathogens like Shigella, but also provides a structural blueprint for engineering ultra-efficient RNA labeling tools.
It's a true paradigm shift for both medicine and biotechnology.
What does this mean for the future of synthetic mRNA therapeutics now that we can label and modify them with such high affinity? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
I watch the bright screen cut the night into a dimer in the spotlight, steady and true. It pulls one loop and flips it into view, then reaches again like it always knew. Not just one lock turning out one spark alone, two active hearts in the same backbone. Hold it, trap it, let the picture show. What we couldn't see is starting to glow. Two hands on the same. Codine. The whole room aligns when it binds, when it binds. Yeah, it binds. Yeah, it binds. Eyes. Positive edges guide the thread through the scene. K's and an R like rails for the dream. A tyrosine steady, a loop that can sway. If you change those anchors, the magic slips away. So we fold a new hairpin, make the signal stay. Dual tag, grip tight in a cleaner way. Lower the distance, raise the chance to see. Label the moment, set the RNA free. Two hands on the same.